Hello and welcome to episode 264 of AvTalk. I am Ian Pechnik here, as always, with
Jason Rabinowitz. Hello, Ian. How's it going?
Hello, Jason. It's going well. How are you, sir?
It's good. You sound in better spirits than usual. I think I know why, but you sound happy, and that's good.
It's been a good week so far. At least since the start of the business week. The weekend was a little bit busy for all the wrong reasons, but we'll get into that in just a minute. But yeah, things are going well. We're getting into the figuring out what everyone's doing for the summer routine. So we've got some camps and things squared away, but now we can start looking at, are we going to travel and where are we going to go? So I'm excited about that.
I will be here all summer, you know?
Well, then maybe it's a lot easier for me.
Yeah, I'll just be here at my desk doing work.
Yeah.
That's fun. Well,
there is that.
Yep.
But this weekend, I had big plans for the yard, you know, making everything look
nice. You got to take care of the yard.
But that didn't really happen because Iran retaliated against Israel for a strike on its consulate compound in Syria that took place at the beginning of April. Over the weekend, Iran sent hundreds of cruise missiles, one-way drones, and various other aerial assault vehicles from Iranian airspace to, ostensibly, to try and hit Israel. Nearly all of those were intercepted either by Israeli defenses, Jordanian defenses, U.S. defenses. And there may have been others, I'm not sure, given all of the military equipment that is operating in the region. But as far as commercial aircraft are concerned, it was a giant, giant security issue and giant, giant headache. I almost said a word that is not family-oriented podcast appropriate. It began with a C and it ended with a K.
I think I know the one.
Yeah, I think everyone can probably guess. But what happened was Jordan closed its airspace. They were the first to close their airspace. Iraq also closed its airspace. Lebanon closed its airspace. And then obviously Israel closed its airspace. Syria is already mostly no-go for nearly all aircraft, except those operating by the regional airlines operating either to Syria itself or through Syria to Lebanon. Most airlines earlier in the week had already stopped flying through Iran, and Iran didn't close its airspace entirely. They activated a protocol that removes traffic from the western half of Iran. So basically from the border with Iraq all the way kind of a few hundred kilometers east of Tehran, turns that into basically what's a no-go area for commercial traffic, and then routes things upwards to the north. This didn't cancel a ton of flights, but what it did do is put tremendous pressure on the routes that remained available. And this is just a continuing story in the compression of so much of the traffic going between Europe and Asia. And so there's really the northern route now, which is through Turkey, through Georgia, Azerbaijan, and further on to the east until you can basically cut down through Afghanistan now. Or you can go south and route through Egypt and Saudi Arabia. Depending on where you're going and where you're coming from, either option might make sense for you. But this is just another step in the continued compression of traffic. That lasted for a few days, and then things have slowly gotten back to normal as airlines begin routing through Iraq again. Airlines still mostly avoiding Iran, except a few. Jazeera, Emirates, Wizz is still using Iranian airspace. Turkish, obviously, still using Iranian airspace. So a few big airlines still using it, but a lot of the international carriers that are just using it as a gateway between Europe and Asia, not. Not a great situation, especially since Israel says that it is going to retaliate once again, which could lead to, again, the closure of more airspace.
Okay, retaliating for retaliation seems like escalation.
We don't talk politics specifically. We talk a lot of geopolitics on this podcast because aviation is a huge factor in geopolitics. But I think it's worth mentioning that Iran tweeted out, I think it was the deputy foreign minister or foreign minister.
The matter is concluded.
We consider this matter concluded.
Okay.
Like they were ending a meeting. I mean, good for them, but it doesn't seem like the Israelis consider the matter concluded, and they have vowed to retaliate once again. Further affecting all of this, as far as the commercial aviation component goes, is that GPS jamming and spoofing have been intense.
It's
in
bad.
The region.
It's already. Really bad.
It got, I don't want to put a number on it and be wrong, but it got a lot worse. We saw basically jamming as wide and as far as the eye could see, as well as an increase in spoofing. So you had the random flights landing in Beirut that were clearly not landing in Beirut. So it's become even more of an issue. Ops Group this week, which we've talked to Mark Z, who is one of the founders of Ops Group, but also we talk about them on a general basis because they're an excellent resource for operators. But they are at odds, basically, with the Israeli government and with EASA, the European Union Aviation Safety Administration, saying those organizations are saying there's minimal impact. You can continue to operate in areas that are not NOTAM closed without issue. And Ops Group is coming back and saying, no, we're experiencing significant problems, especially with GPS jamming. And we're dealing with very, very clear uncertainty about the safety of the airspace at any given moment. So they're telling their members to be extremely careful, which I think is good, solid advice.
Yeah. I was thinking the other day, we've heard a lot from the pilot perspective and the operational perspective, but I was thinking, what is it like for the passengers on these flights? Everyone's obviously, the moving map channel is one of the most popular things for passengers to look at. What are they seeing when GPS is jammed or spoofed? Is the system just going to kind of not show anything, or is it showing the aircraft where it is definitely not? Do people kind of panic and say, oh my God, why are we not where we're supposed to be? I haven't heard of any passenger saying anything in that regard. And now I'm wondering what happens.
Yeah. I mean, if you've been on one of those flights, email us podcast@fr24.com. Let us know what you've seen. We also had our colleague Gabriel on an SAS flight that experienced significant GPS jamming. They didn't experience any spoofing to my knowledge, but they did experience significant GPS jamming. But he was in the flight deck, so I'm not sure if he got a glimpse at the moving map, but it's a really interesting question. So if anyone out there knows or has seen it, or if you're going to be on a flight where you're flying through some of these regions, snap a picture and let us know.
If Ian, you want to, you know, buy me a nice ticket to somewhere that may have some GPS jamming or spoofing, I can go find out myself. You can even come with me.
I think the obvious choice here is to put you on one of the Singapore flights. You know, just
obviously.
Just fine. Yeah. You know, of course.
I am willing to take on this mission.
That is so gracious of you, Jason. So absolutely
you can come
gracious
too.
Of you.
It'll be a great time.
And so just to close this part of the conversation, we come round to Malaysia, which through its aviation administration has put out a conflict zone notice. I think rightfully so, given Malaysia's history flying through conflict zones. They say, hey, this is in fact a conflict zone. There are long-range surface-to-air missiles, coordination irregularities, and a risk of miscalculation or misidentification by air defense systems. This is not hypothetical. This has happened to Malaysia Airlines in 2014, and it happened to Ukraine International Airlines in Iran in 2020. So these are not hypothetical questions. And so I think it's really interesting to me that Malaysia is doing this, but I don't think they're out of line at all.
No. There is really no other airline in a better position to be making such a statement. I don't think anyone would refute that.
We'll continue to keep watch on this. I think the interesting thing here overall is that if something were to happen that results in a wider regional conflict on a longer term basis, there's very few places that all of this traffic can go, because there's just so much of it and there's only so much airspace if we start to see larger closures. So we're going to keep a very close eye on this. And unfortunately, I'm sure we'll be talking about this again.
Yeah, not great, but hey, maybe things improve. Who knows?
Maybe. We can only hope.
Probably not, but fingers crossed.
Probably not. Yeah. We'll just leaving that on a hopeful note, I guess. Now we go to Washington, D.C., where there was a congressional hearing today that told us, I don't know what it told us. Did it tell us anything?
Words were said. I don't think anything new was said, but people had things to say. That's always nice. I think that's kind of the point of these hearings or sessions or whatever.
So what this was, is it was a Senate hearing on Boeing whistleblowers and how Boeing's safety culture has failed, basically. And they had a few whistleblowers, and they had a professor from The Ohio State University that spoke to, you know, what is safety culture, how does it operate, and things like that, which I thought was a good introduction.
Yeah.
But I think John Ostrower had the, you know, kind of the summation here. He said, the hardest part of this hearing is that it's being held by senators asking questions who have very little idea of what's actually going on or how any of this works, and it's obscuring thoughtful commentary and information from being provided by the panelists. And I thought that was, I mean, that could honestly, that could describe 95% of congressional hearings. But I think, you know, in this particular case, you always want to hear from people who are experts in the field and people who have firsthand experience. But their expertise and experience is often lost in these hearings. So this hearing itself, I don't know if it really moved the needle. The reporting that comes after this hearing, perhaps, follow-up hearings maybe could be of use, but it doesn't seem to me that we really learned anything. Boeing, for its part, released a statement after the hearing that just said, because the hearing focused on possible or alleged deficiencies with how Boeing manufactures the 787. And Boeing says that the 787 fleet is fine. They say that the aircraft can safely operate for at least 30 years before needing expanded airframe maintenance routines. They say that the testing of the fuselage and heavy maintenance checks have found zero evidence of airframe fatigue. The whistleblower was saying, yes, all of those tests are well and good, but you haven't tested all of these things on fuselages that we know were jammed together. So,
oh, jammed together. This is the one we're talking about with the guy is jumping on the fuselage to get the pieces to fit, right?
The jumping was the trouble. Oh, okay. But the, this
I'm getting my fuselage joining, jamming, jumping things confused.
So this particular reference was that the 787s, when you put the carbon fiber fuselages together, they don't fit together exactly right. So you have to have shims involved. So the way that you're supposed to do that is you put the fuselage pieces together without joining them, determine the tolerances, and add shims as necessary. What this person is alleging, who is a quality manager at Boeing, he's saying that Boeing would shove the two fuselage sections together too hard. And then because they used too much force to push them together, they didn't need to shim them. Because when they went to measure for the shims, they said, oh, we don't need shims.
Oh, okay. Sure.
And so Boeing says that they found no evidence of any issues thus far.
Yeah. It's very interesting to see the stance Boeing is taking on this one, as opposed to the 7-3, which is very apologetic, admitting mistakes were made, safety lapses happened, and things will change, and things will get better. The tone is very, very different coming from Boeing. It's kind of an all-out defensive stance here from Boeing. They've put out statements, which I guess I can read here. Ian, why don't I just read this?
Go for it.
They tweeted out today or posted, and I quote, in 13 years of service, the Global 787 fleet has safely transported more than 850 million passengers on more than 4.2 million flights. A 787 can safely operate for at least 30 years before needing expanded airframe maintenance routines. Extensive and rigorous testing of the fuselage and heavy maintenance checks of nearly 700 in-service airplanes to date have found zero evidence of airframe fatigue. Under FAA oversight, we have painstakingly inspected and reworked airplanes and improved production quality to meet exacting standards. We are fully confident in safety and durability of the 787 Dreamliner. End quote. There are some pretty heavy-handed words there. Extensive, rigorous, painstakingly, exacting. These are not words that should be used lightly. So Boeing is being very clear, very, very defensively saying the 787 is fine. Curiously, it doesn't mention the 777, though I guess that doesn't matter at this point. But they are very defensive that the 787 is not the 73 MAX. There is something distinctly different here. They link to a microsite called boeing.com/787quality info. So it's not just a post. It's a whole microsite describing. You could watch the 787 fatigue testing and the static testing and all the manufacturing stuff and the certification process. So Boeing has come out swinging on the defense here. I think that's smart. You don't want the flying public to think everything you produce is a piece of crap. Yeah, the 787 has had its issues in the past, but it really seems like Boeing is trying extra hard to prevent the flying public from thinking everything is a problem, that it is confident in the 787. And that's what's being echoed by, I think, every airline that has mentioned the topic as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to me how they've come out in such a manner, as well as the fact that it was really, I think it was Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin who was like, we don't want to give the impression that none of these planes are safe. And I don't know exactly who on that the panel looked at it and he was like, oh yeah, no, they are. And so it was one of those things where I think everybody's trying to get to the point where they're saying, look, there is a problem, culturally speaking, but we're not saying each airplane is unsafe, which is a weird position to be in.
Yeah.
Because we've gotten to the point where, I mean, continuing airworthiness directives and airworthiness directives for, you know, problems and issues are not new. They happen across all airplanes. They're issued all the time. I think the FAA issued 7 or 8 of them today alone. And they're things where there is a discovered problem with an extremely complex machine. It needs to be addressed to make things safer. And to kind of blow each and everything out of proportion, I think is a danger given the hyper-focus. And we talked about this a couple episodes ago where everyone's focusing on these things, perhaps to the detriment of a wider picture and saying, hey, what do we do about the culture in order to ensure that these things happen as infrequently as humanly possible and that we don't make easy mistakes like forgetting to put bolts back in when we replace the door?
That's a good plan.
Let's go over to United, which reported its earnings this week. And they say, hey.
Lack of earnings, maybe.
Well, they had lots of earnings.
They had earnings, not enough to get over the zero mark. Yeah.
Yeah.
But we know whose fault it is.
Well, exactly. United lays this squarely at Boeing's feet. United generated $12.5 billion of revenue in the first 3 months of the year.
That's a lot of 10%.
That's a lot of and snack boxes. Up 10% over the first quarter in 2023. However, they took a charge of $200 million for the 737 MAX 9 grounding and ended up losing $124 million in the first quarter. So didn't swing a profit in the first quarter.
Not great, but it was better than apparently expected. And yeah. United stock went up, which is fun.
I mean, if you like to invest in airlines, first of all, why? Second of all, if you invested in United this week, I guess you're up. But it's interesting, less so the earnings, because there was kind of expected that things would go the way they did. But as part of their earnings release, we also got some very interesting information. Jason, where are the planes coming from now?
So United is scrambling. We know that. Its major domestic fleet expansion was centered around the 737 MAX 10. That is now a giant question mark. They will be delivered eventually someday, probably, but not today, not tomorrow, probably not even this year or next. So United has not been quiet in saying we need more Airbus narrow bodies. And it has found 35 of them, 35 A321neos from lessors that will be delivered, I think, in 2026, 2027 range. So it's not immediate. It's still going to be a few years, unfortunately. But the interesting thing is that they will be CFM LEAP 1A powered A321neos. As any regular listener of this podcast would know, the 321neo any of those powered by the Pratt & Whitney engine has been problematic, including United Aircraft, along with JetBlue, being pressed into service and almost immediately suffering from an engine failure, sidelighting the aircraft in multiple engines. So United defecting, it's a double defection. It's United defecting from Boeing to Airbus and defecting from Pratt & Whitney to CFM, which is just, I'm not going to say it's unprecedented, but for an airline to split up the fleet commonality in the engine types it's taking on, that is not something you typically see. That is complicated. And that is a whole host of issues will be introduced by them. But apparently at United, they think it will be worth the trouble to get engines on airplanes that do not fail virtually immediately after being put into service.
I wonder how complicated it will be, because United has hundreds of LEAP 1B sitting around.
Yes, it does. Which makes you think, why didn't they just take the CFM on the 321neos from the onset? I don't know. That may have been...
Jason, that's a great question.
That is a great question. Thank you for leading me right into it. It is very interesting. Unfortunately, these are not coming anytime soon. I had a piece of information that I pulled out from United's earnings call. They converted a whole bunch of 737 MAX 10s to the MAX 9 from 2025 through 2027 with the rights to increase. I think this is like over 100 aircraft. It's a sizable chunk of its order, but there's still a sizable chunk left because United ordered an absolute ton of these things. In 2024, United expects to take delivery of just 61 narrow-body aircraft and just 5 wide-body aircraft. And when you read the before and after, it's kind of staggering where we're at now. United was very aggressive. It was going to be a huge fleet expansion and fleet replacement for United. We knew, they knew, that manufacturing delays, defects, issues were starting to pile up. United said they had contractual aircraft commitments for 183 narrow-body deliveries in 2024. But at the beginning of this year, only 101 were to be expected. That's a dramatic decrease by 82. However, due to Boeing's latest issues, that number drops to the now 61 figure. So a reduction of 122 aircraft down to just 61, that is crazy how many aircraft United thought it was going to get and is now actually getting. It's basically rewriting its entire fleet, its entire expansion, its entire network planning. At this point, it's going to be a completely different operation because aircraft manufacturers and engine manufacturers can't get their act together.
I mean, my mind is still boggled by how many aircraft they were planning to take in the first place.
They were in that phase where they were going to take like multiple aircraft a week. That was their big marketing line with the whole United Next program to totally refurbish their fleet. We were going to take more than at least one aircraft a week in 2024. And now that's down to like, not a whole lot.
So are we officially rebranding United Next to United Soon?
United Eventually.
United Eventually. Oh, God, that's the worst marketing tagline ever. Well, good luck to them. And I think the thing that impresses me here is the airline's ability, and not just United's ability, but multiple airlines' ability to navigate these aircraft, either because of airframes in the case of United or engine issues like Wizz, you know, where they're really doing their darndest to navigate these issues as they come up. And the plans that they have in place aren't necessarily, you know, coming to fruition, but they're doing their best, I think, to not impact passengers as much as possible. And I'm seeing that come through.
Yeah. But then there's the icing and the cherry on top of the cake of the FAA issues, where they're taking delivery of these aircraft and they can't even put them into service right now. And they also can't start operating routes that they want to announce or they have announced and they have to delay by months or even a year. So if you are a network or route or fleet planner at United, let us know and we'll buy you a drink because you're probably having a rough couple months.
We apologize for all of this.
I didn't even think of that until now, that not only are Boeing and Airbus not able to deliver anything like what they were promised. But then when they get the few aircraft they are getting, they can't even put them into service.
They can't put them into service.
Ah, that's not great.
Hey, let's go to China.
All right.
I love Chinese food. You can't see a facepalm through the podcast, but you can feel it.
I heard it, actually.
There you go. The Civil Aviation Administration of China has released its first quarter statistics, and things are going very well.
Finally.
38% increase in traffic, up to 180 million passengers. Domestic traffic is well above pre-pandemic levels, 10% higher compared to the first quarter of 2019. And the entirety of Chinese traffic grew 46%.
Wow.
So things have really, really come back. Domestic traffic in China continues to lead by far. So this is really interesting breakdown because Chinese domestic traffic, 160 million passengers. So they reported a total traffic of 180 million. And 160 of that was domestic. I mean, which I think is really indicative of how many people and how much demand there is for domestic air travel in China, but how limited the international growth really has been, especially since the pandemic.
Yeah, since COVID, the massive amount of international travel from Chinese tourists has not bounced back, but also the capacity from Chinese airlines, especially to the US, is nowhere near at the levels it used to be. I'm not going to say they capacity dumped to the US, but if you wanted to fly from the US to Southeast Asia or really anywhere in Asia, there's a good chance there was a Chinese airline ready, willing, and able to undercut everyone else by hundreds of dollars. And to that effect, this week, the U.S. airlines, via their lobbying groups, asked the Biden administration to not approve additional flights between the U.S. and China, since this is still a strict, there's no open skies agreement, I don't believe. There's still a very strict number of flights. It was recently increased that Chinese airlines could upgrade from 35 to 50 flights per week starting March 31st, so a couple weeks ago. But the Chinese Aviation Authority wanted more, of course they do, to get capacity back to where it was. And the U.S. airline lobbying groups are saying, no, absolutely not, due to a couple of factors, because some of the Chinese airlines are state-backed. They are still taking Russian airspace shortcuts that the U.S. airlines cannot take in some cases. But to me, it has very interesting overtones of what the U.S. airlines were bickering about years ago with the Middle Eastern airlines that seemed to just disappear as an issue one day. That focus has seemed to shift from the Middle Eastern three are evil and they're going to put everyone out of business to the Chinese airlines are evil and they're going to put us all out of business. They've kind of made that jump without really acknowledging that they've made that jump, but here we are.
There are some legitimate issues here, but yeah, I think there absolutely is certainly a risk of falling into that trap where you have U.S. airlines arguing against kind of Chinese traffic writ large rather than saying, okay, we need to make sure that this is equitable based on, you know, what we can get for both sets of carriers.
Yeah. It's not like back in the spat with the Middle Eastern three where the U.S. airlines were calling out airlines by a name and saying, Qatar is bad and they're state-backed and here's the documents to prove that they get all this government funding. It's much more low-key and saying, hey, there's advantages like shorter routes and I don't know, maybe they get, and I'm quoting here, certain protections from Chinese governments because they're state-owned. Like, yeah, there are some legitimate arguments there. It's a lower-key argument, but definitely the same vibes coming out of the lobbying groups in the U.S.
Yeah, we can call it same vibes. Where do we want to go? Do we want to go to Greece or Australia next?
I'd love to go to Greece.
All right, we'll go to Greece then. Aegean Air is going to extend their A321 orders. It's unclear as yet whether or not these will be specially configured regular old A321neos, whether they'll be A321LRs, or whether they'll be A321XLRs. But they want to go further afield. They're looking at Gulf states, they're looking at Africa, and they're looking at Central Asia, which is, I think, just a fascinating expansion of things that you wouldn't think Aegean would be looking at without the ability to have a bit more range from the A321.
Yeah, and we're not sure if this is the 321LR or the XLR at this point, since these plans are still a couple years off, but it's very...
Or a mystical A321ER.
Ooh, we don't know. Maybe there's room for that.
We don't know.
But it's definitely interesting that what is, I would say, a premium low-cost airline, I guess maybe just regular airline. Do those still exist at this point?
Sure, why not?
Sure, but they'll be going all in on the long-haul experience with an actual business, lie-flat business class product, Wi-Fi, and seatback screen. So it'll be a very different version of the Aegean Airlines we know today. Unfortunately, these aircraft will not be able to make the hop to North America, which I think would be wildly successful if they were able to get that range. But maybe some hypothetical 321neo ER in the future could do that. But as it is today...
An XLRER.
Yeah, it's the current fleet's just not going to get it done.
Just by the A330.
No. We've talked about this before. That's the pitfall airlines fall into. They go too big, they can't make it work, and then the whole airline evaporates. You don't want that.
That's fair.
You never want to go full wowware.
All right. Do we want to do Australia or Russia or Dubai? I mean, really, these are all kind of a grab bag of stories.
I don't want to keep kicking Australia down the road. They'll think we're not giving them their due time here. So let's go to Australia.
All right. Fair enough. So we go now to Australia, where the ATSB released a report this week that addressed a crew incapacitation event for a Boeing 717 operated by National Jet Systems for Qantas under the QantasLink branding. The cabin crew reported a strong chlorine odor, dizziness, mild discomfort, metallic taste. The flight crew was told of the same. And as they were approaching, this is kind of the beginning of the flight, they were told that, hey, it smells really bad back here. Flight crew said, hey, we don't smell anything. They continued the climb, flew for a little over an hour, and then the flight crew noticed that it started to smell really bad and that they weren't feeling well. The captain noticed, quote, hypoxia-like symptoms, and the captain said, I can't fly. Handed flying over to the first officer, because the first officer was fine. But just before landing, the first officer said, you know what? I'm not feeling good. The aircraft is deviating from the approach path, and I'm having issues, you know, kind of keeping my mental faculties about me. Landed the aircraft. Then they taxi to the terminal, park at the gate, and they all have kind of ongoing symptoms of headaches, lethargy, and had to go to the hospital. ATSB investigation discusses, you know, how the cabin air quality system works and doesn't really get into exactly what specifically may have happened to cause this odor. But they also discuss how the use of supplemental oxygen and declaring a pan would have addressed the issue much more effectively than saying, I feel okay right now.
Yeah, I don't know what declaring pan would accomplish other than getting air traffic control's attention and maybe priority, but certainly supplemental
oxygen what it would accomplish.
Would have been prudent here, probably. Of course, hindsight is 20/20, and if you're cognitive facilities are impaired, maybe you're not thinking about that. Maybe that's why they didn't do that. But yeah, it certainly seems like oxygen would have helped in this situation if there's a weird smell and suddenly you're not thinking straight. Yeah, that would probably be a good decision. But if you're not thinking straight, maybe that's why they didn't do it. A lot to consider there, and lots of checklists and guidelines and airline manuals that need to be updated. I think they mentioned that to reflect that in any case.
Correct.
Where something doesn't smell right, maybe put the mask on.
But the interesting thing here is that the report mentions that the first officer said that instead of donning the oxygen mask and conducting a go-around, he thought it would be safer to conduct a landing and just not deal with the oxygen mask. So I thought that was an interesting comment about what the pilots were thinking. And then in reflection of that, National Jet Systems has kind of reiterated their handbook and revised their handbook to include, okay, put the oxygen mask on in the event of any fume event, and then make a decision based on, you know, what do you need to do now? Nothing bad happened. They were fine. They went to the hospital. They were checked out. Their blood was slightly elevated with CO2 levels, but the test proved inconclusive about exactly what had happened. You know, it's interesting to note how these reports can lead to safety improvements and should lead to safety improvements. So I think that's a good takeaway from this particular episode. You know what's not being taken away? At least in one piece.
Certain URL A320 in a field?
Definitely, definitely not.
Ah, so sad. Apparently, the URL A320 that was poorly piloted and ended up in a field in Russia will not be flown out because it's too expensive, the dirt's not right, it costs too much to keep the site secure, and hey, it'll just become a parts cow at that point. But
I hate it when the dirt's not right.
Yeah, would have been high hopes to see that thing fly out, but it's if they can't make it work, no one can.
Yeah, I really thought that they were going to do it. I thought that was going to be like a really, really exciting thing to watch. There would be a dash cam live stream with a huge watermark over it and terrible music. I was really looking forward to that.
Yep, but now you can look forward to individual parts being slowly trucked out until there's nothing left.
All right. This week in Dubai, there was a massive, massive storm. Enough rain fell in such a short period of time that the Dubai International Airport was turned into the Dubai International Seaport.
All right. A new variant of the 737 MAX, the amphibious version, apparently, at Fly Dubai was developed.
Yes.
Very quickly.
Yes. The video from the airport showed considerable amount of water, just enough to not have the bottom of the engine cowl in the water.
Seems like a bad idea. Really should be doing that.
I was surprised by that.
You shouldn't be doing that. I had this conversation on the social medias, and sure, the plane could do it, but when the airport's flooded, there's going to be all sorts of crap floating around in there, and you can't see it. It is, I think, merely luck that they did not ingest anything into an engine or damage the aircraft in any dramatic way. Who knows what other damage may occur, but anytime there's a flash flood or anything, the National Weather Service here in the U.S. is always very intent in saying, turn around, don't drown, don't drive into water because you can't see the bottom. You don't know what's in there. I don't think taxiing a 737 into floodwaters is really a wise decision.
Not the best move. Certainly not the best move.
No, but they're still dealing with it. Emirates, for the second day in a row, is basically a shell of its regular operation to the point where it's not even letting passengers check in originating at Dubai. They're only focusing on transit passengers. So if you're trying to leave Dubai, tough, deal with it. You're going to have to take your turn and wait. But I thought it was really interesting to watch as the airport was struggling and flights couldn't land, the amount of airborne holding for a place that already has a pretty significant
amount of airborne holding
on a good day. So some of these flights added hours onto their route. I think yesterday, a Fly Dubai flight from, I think it was Kazakhstan to Dubai, typical flight time is 3.5 hours. This flight lasted 5 hours and 45 minutes. So they added more than 2 hours of flight time just in holding time, which is pretty remarkable. That's a lot of holding for not a very long flight.
It's terrible to be a passenger in that respect, but thinking of being one of the pilots or being the pilots up there, because it's not a situation where you can kind of relax like it's a normal cruise situation, because you're always on edge for, okay, we're leaving the holding, or we're expecting, you know, we need to change altitude because there's another aircraft coming in, or, you know, so on and so forth. But it's also super boring because you're just flying in a racetrack pattern.
But here's the thing, in Dubai, I think London is a bit like this to a certain degree. It's not like New York, where often they put you in a holding pattern. They stack flights over 1,000 feet over each other, and they just do a cycle track over and over and over and over in the same spot. This Fly Dubai flight was going everywhere. It was all over the country. It was all over the place. And I think this is pretty common for the UAE, where they're not just circling over a fixed point. They're going over a fixed point for a little bit and then moving 10 miles to the west. And then they're doing a big loop over here over the water, and then doing another little squiggly thing. And they're kind of all over the place. I don't know how the UAE air traffic controllers do this, but they are very good at what they do in keeping these aircraft separated. But just some of the flight patterns are remarkable. It just looks like a toddler kind of drew crayon scratches all over the map.
Do you remember when iOS apps were new? Do you remember the game Flight Control?
I still have that game because it's built into the United
app. It is built into the new United app. That's true. So it always reminds me of that.
More or less, yeah.
Where you're dragging the path of the aircraft to try and land and not have any of them hit anywhere. Obviously, a little bit more involved than that.
A little bit more complicated.
But, you know, the same principle applies. Hey, Jason.
Yes.
Did you hear the one about the missing gold bars?
I didn't, even though it happened last year. I love a good airport heist. I don't love participating in them. I love reading about a good airport heist, whether it's watching the movie Goodfellas or reading the actual news about an Air Canada heist.
Yeah, this story was flagged by a listener, a very helpful listener. So thank you so much for flagging this particular story. This was published today, the 17th of April, on the one-year anniversary of the theft. So I actually hadn't noticed this for an entire year. But they've identified 9 individuals that they believe were involved in the theft and have arrested 5 of them and issued warrants for 3 others. So I'm interested to know about the 9th guy. Like, what's his deal?
Yeah, you don't got to worry about the 9th guy.
But they are accused of participating in the theft of 6,600 gold bars, along with other gold items and various currencies. The gold and currencies were on their way from a Swiss bank in Zurich to Toronto. Brinks was hired to move the items and contracted with Air Canada to fly them. They were taken off the plane. The gold and the currency was taken off the plane and brought to an Air Canada facility in Toronto. And here's the absolute best part of the story. The thieves used a duplicate airway bill for a seafood shipment for the previous day in order to remove the gold and currency from the cargo facility.
Man, you'd like to think there's a bit more security baked into things like this. Maybe a phone call or some sort of, I don't know, something more than just looking at a paper that's clearly for a different thing for a different date would raise an alarm. But my favorite part is that they only realized all the gold and the money and all the financial nonsense was missing after Brinks showed up 3 hours later to collect it and found it was gone. I feel like if I was anticipating a delivery of like $20 million worth of gold, I'd show up on time. I would not be late for that delivery. I'd not be 3 hours late.
If only Brinks had used Flight Radar 24 to track the aircraft.
They could have known. I mean, I know I've seen pictures and videos of like a Brinks truck rolling up to an aircraft to take it directly off the aircraft. And I guess it's a little more complicated. This was an international flight. It probably had to go through customs or something. But if a thief can come in and collect it 3 hours before the globally based armored courier company can manage, maybe they should look inward and not outward.
Well, to address that, Brinks has actually sued Air Canada, saying that Air Canada was negligent. Air Canada says, no, you should have come and picked up your gold.
I mean, maybe they're both right.
I don't know the particularities of the lawsuit, but just an interesting story flagged by a listener. So thank you very much for this interesting story. Hopefully they catch everybody involved, which gives them enough material to turn this into a new heist movie.
I hope they get away with it. If it was this easy, they deserve it.
Nah, they already know who they are. They're not getting away with it.
Nah. Except that 9th guy?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Wait, are you the 9th guy?
Shh.
Hey, let's talk about eels.
What? That's a transition. Yep.
There's nothing transitory about that. Okay, so here's the thing. I have learned more than I ever wanted to learn about eels within the past week. So here's the thing that caught our attention. There was an aircraft transiting from it's a UK registered aircraft that's transiting from a Danish island to Kaliningrad.
Okay.
First of all, that's incredibly strange given all of the situations. But the aircraft's registration is G Eels. G-E-E-L-S. And so being interested in why this aircraft has made this flight multiple times in the past month, I Googled G Eels. As it turns out, they have a website. We are based at Gloucestershire Airport. During the winter months, our aircraft is used to transport valuable live baby eels, glass eels, all over Europe for restocking and farming, either from our base in the UK or our aquaculture holding in France. Over the summer months, you can rent out our aircraft for whatever you want. I'm paraphrasing that last sentence there. So apparently, the eel trade is a big business. Then some helpful folks on the socials media filled us in that those eels can go for more than $5,000 a piece.
And I bet whoever was picking those up from the airport was on time.
It all comes back together. So if you're interested in following what I assume are eel drops into Kaliningrad, G Eels is the aircraft you want to be tracking.
I just love that there's a whole website that is telling you about this. They seem very proud of their eel aircraft. I mean, who wouldn't be?
They're very into their eels.
Good for them.
There's a niche for everything.
There's something to be said about doing something so specific that you register the aircraft to say exactly what it is you're doing.
I can't argue with that. Jason, we close the show this week with a bit of a competition. Tell us more about that.
Okay. This one comes to us from the Wall Street Journal. And I don't think I knew this was a thing, or I forgot it was a thing because I read about it before. But there was a aircraft mechanic competition held recently. Wherever the McCormick Place Convention Center is, I'm not actually sure.
That's Chicago.
Chicago. Oh, Chicago.
I wish they had told
you
me.
Not attend?
I would have gone.
You should attend
didn't
next
know
year.
About it.
Apparently, there's an annual, or at least I think it is an annual, aircraft mechanics competition where groups of mechanics from various airlines are in competition with each other to do things the fastest, the safest, the most complete in 15 minutes or less. And apparently, FedEx Express has been the two-time reigning champion, but this time Team Herb from Southwest Airlines took home the victory, which is apparently a four-foot trophy with the bust of the mechanic who worked with the Wright brothers. This story is great. They did various things like replacing a fan blade on an engine of a 767. All sorts of other things. Some airlines, unfortunately, were a little disadvantaged because they don't work on 767s. If you're from Spirit Airlines, who had a lovely quote who said, "We did our best. We did what we can." We're just Spirit, all right? The exact quote is, "We're out here doing our best." Yeah, I'd say that's true. That's generally the case for everything Spirit Airlines does, right? They're just having fun out there doing the best they can. But it's just really interesting that there's this competition for aircraft mechanics, because of course there is. It's a competition for everything. But I am just disappointed that we did not know it and we did not attend to see this in person. Because apparently United chopped off the front end of a 767 and donated it to this to actually be in the competition, which is pretty great.
Oh, all right. Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So for those that are interested, the next competition is April 8th through the 10th, next year, 2025, in Atlanta. So book your tickets now and get ready to go.
I think it'd be fun. I actually want to attend this.
No, I actually want to go as well. I'm genuinely disappointed that I didn't know that that was happening and did not go.
In your own town.
In my own town. Well, there's always next year and there's always Atlanta. So I think we call that an episode. This has been episode 264 of AvTalk. Thank you all so very much for listening. We appreciate each and every one of you. We appreciate that you have taken to various podcast listening platforms to leave ratings and reviews. But if you haven't done that yet and you're feeling so inclined, we would love for you to do that. It helps other people find the podcast, which we like. It helps us keep doing what we're doing. So go on and do that if you'd like. I am Ian Pechnik, here as always with
Jason Rabinowitz. Thanks for listening.